100%, 64 degrees Kenosha, 62 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days they are on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I feel very privileged indeed to be able to talk on today's morning show about a really powerful and poignant documentary film that is going to be screened in Kenosha on Thursday evening, September 19th. The film is titled Jen Silent. It was actually made back in 2011, and I feel very happy to be speaking today with Stu Maddox, who both directed and produced the film. The film follows the lives of six LGBT senior citizens who are basically confronting an array of difficult issues, and some of them fairly common issues when it comes to senior citizens, but other issues that are more tightly related to the fact that they might be gay or transgender or whatever. And the way in, especially in which they are dealt with by the long-term healthcare industry, and to what extent they feel isolated and or forgotten, perhaps estranged from their family, maybe feel in a sense left out of the wider gay rights movement and the gay community. All kinds of intriguing questions that might not otherwise ever occur to us, but that are brought forward beautifully by this film. It's going to be, as I said, screened on Thursday, September 19th, actually on the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College, and is being presented in cooperation with Hospice Alliance and with St. Matthew's Episcopal Church Community Tithe. And I'm very privileged to speak with Stu Maddox, who is an award-winning a producer and director of a number of different nonfiction films, and his trophy shelf at home includes a number of regional Emmy Awards, and he has worked tirelessly in the whole field of LGBTQ rights. And Stu Maddox, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks, Greg. It's good to be here. Thanks for that great introduction.
I really am happy to speak with you, and I'm delighted to speak with you about this really beautiful film. I would love to learn a little bit more about you and about this this film producing group that you head up called the Clowder Group and the kind of films that you make. But give us some sense of background first of what took you to this place where you find yourself creating these powerful documentary films.
Well, it was kind of a circuitous route to get here. I started out as a television reporter and an anchor and got to a place where I wanted to work on longer form projects like documentaries. And I did that for networks for a while and then got to a place where I realized there were certain topics that were really important to me that probably wouldn't get made unless I made them independently. And about that time, I met my life partner, who's also in L.A. at that point where I was, and we teamed up to go make what's called, well, we teamed up in life, but we also teamed up in business and in making these films that hopefully will make the world a little bit better.
Very good. I wonder if you would mind saying a little bit just about your own story in terms of your work in media and at what point issues related to the gay rights movement became central to your work, even before you began to set off on making documentary films around that topic. But even ahead of that, at some point, did this start to become, in a sense, a signature of who you were professionally?
You know, that's a really excellent question, because for a long time, at the point that I entered, say, local television, it wasn't very cool to be out. And at the time, you could, and you still can, get fired for your gender preference or sexual orientation or who you choose to love. So I think in the back of the mind that was percolating for a long time. If I ever get the chance to really tell, I guess, what's a little bit my story, like it is everyone else's, then I'll take that opportunity. And as I made these individual documentaries, I've learned, I guess, what everybody else knew in the documentary world, that these topics end up being more about yourself than you think. You think you're doing something to go out there and change the world, and it turns out a film about growing old LGBT is a film about your fears about growing old LGBT, and so on.
Interesting. I wonder if you could say a word about the kind of stories you have felt compelled to tell. And we'll, of course, eventually get to Jen Silent, which is a very specific story and in many respects a largely untold story. I mean, many stories are told about this community, but there are certain stories left largely untold. I'm just kind of curious what you and your partner, Joseph Applebaum, have kind of thought about or wrestled with in terms of what stories within the gay community needed to be told and why.
That's an interesting way to look at what you do next as a documentary filmmaker. There's really two important criteria, and there's what you really want to do and what's going to be interesting to your audience, say, in about 2 years when you have whatever you're creating finished. So it's a process of kind of trying to look at what's coming down the pike as far as really important social issues around this particular topic, and also what's going to carry you through personally as a filmmaker. What's going to keep you making this film when the money is low, the hours are long, but still keep you passionate about it? And it's some form of, for me personally, some form of social injustice out there, something where this is just wrong, and I feel like I want to use my powers for good to be able to, make things a little bit better. So I think, both of those things. There's a practical consideration, and then there's also the passionate consideration.
I'd also love to just have a brief word on how you and your partner, Joseph Applebaum, work together, how you collaborate on these films. What, in a sense, what shape does that collaboration take? What do each of you bring to the table with each of these projects?
I think it changes from project to project, and indeed, from week to week, I often go ask other couples who are working together how they do it, and I've learned a lot from them, because it really is a challenge to divide and conquer and to make it fulfilling for both people. And I often feel like I get to do all the fun stuff, which is go out and interview people and create beautiful pictures and story. And Joe sometimes has to do the producing, which is going out and fundraising and making sure that we are viable as filmmakers. We can continue to do this independently. But we cross over and we kind of prop each other up when I'm creatively in a bad place, or he's in a place where he would like to be more creative, which I think, Greg, the key is to make it fulfilling for both people, but continue to check and make sure that it is in that moment fulfilling. Nobody wants to do all of one thing or the other, and it's not something you're told you're supposed to leave home at the end of the day, but home is where you work. It's very difficult to kind of just stop working at the end of the day, which I've heard is the secret to couples working together, and we're still working on that to get to that place.
Clearly, from the films that you have already created, including Jen Silent, you have a special concern for, or special sensitivity to, older gays, to senior citizens, for instance, in the gay community, and also a sensitivity to the history of the gay rights movement and, in a sense, a lack of connection between, for instance, young people today and those who have gone before them to help really break down the walls that that some of which, of course, still need to come down, but have really changed the landscape in dramatic ways that somebody who has grown up in this world where that's all they know cannot even imagine all that has happened. Can you trace this concern of yours and this desire to focus on this to anything in particular? Was there a moment when it occurred to you that this was something that really needed to be lifted up, maybe especially for the sake of young people unaware of this history and unaware of this facet of their community?
Well, we right now seem to be in need, a desperate need of those who came before us to kind of tell us how they did it back then. We're going through a lot of the things again that they went through 30 years ago. And so, you know, I don't know where I read that a community can be marginalized if they don't know their history, and I'm sure I'm paraphrasing that. But all the answers to where we need to go and our issues and our challenges, particularly right now, are with those people who came before us. They've been down this road before. And the disconnection that's there is much greater than it is in the mainstream community. There's definitely a disconnection between generations, no doubt about it. I guess, zooming out, I can kind of see that the answers are in one place, and the passion and the energy is in another place. And there is just some way to bring both sides together and have a kind of a transfer of knowledge, you know, a passing on of. That's one thing that the LGBTQ community doesn't have as much of, and endangers it from kind of being marginalized, as I said. There's another really personal part of this, which was, you know, I was looking for examples of successful aging, successful whatever, having successful lives in general when I was much younger. And I know that that's a very common thing for people in the LGBTQ community to not have kind of their queer grandparents, so to speak. You know, we all have many of us have straight grandparents where we get life experience from, but there's a different set of life experience that's needed when you're kind of trying to navigate being different than everybody else, no matter how accepting, you know, your community, your life around you is, the people that you depend on and so on. There's still a difference, and having examples is really important, but they weren't there for me. There's a few, but not very many, and I was wondering why that is. And it turned out not that there aren't older LGBT people. There's plenty. It's just that they are kind of not only moving off to the suburbs like we all do and having lives, but they're just kind of having to also disappear in order to age successfully. And it's at that point where I felt like this is not just them who is suffering. This is me and people who are coming after me who are suffering from not having the voice of that experience. Hmm. And that gave me a really kind of a gut-wrenching feeling.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with filmmaker Stu Maddox, director and producer of a marvelous documentary that will be screened on the Racine campus of Gateway on Thursday, September 19th at 5:30, a film titled Gen Silent that chronicles the experience of six different LGBT seniors who are contending with various difficulties and challenges. Although one must say that this is not a film that is dark and dreary and depressing start to finish. Although there is plenty of sadness, there is also some real joy and inspiration in this film as well. Could you say a word about how you looked for and found these particular people to highlight in your film and whose stories are told so beautifully? I guess that's kind of the kernel of the film. How did you find these particular people and secure their participation in this film?
Well, I wish I could tell you that I was on some long trek across the country, stopping by many different homes and interviewing many different people to find just the right one. But there was a bit of serendipity in this, and also turning to organizations that were already doing this important work with LGBT aging and deciding that, okay, these are the organizations who are really cutting the edge on making this change for all of us. Now let's talk to them about some of the people that they are serving. Who do they know who would be a particularly good example of this particular facet of the problem or going through that type of circumstance? And so we leaned on organizations who are working on LGBT aging to give us people that they serve, and then kind of whittled it down from there to a group of people we began following. And then as life happens in documentary filmmaking, that group gets whittled down to, the remaining six that we have in the film. And this film would be nothing without the power of and personality of the people who happen to be in it. They're amazing people who were willing to share their story. I think through building trust, we all kind of take a chance when we do this. And I'm very proud of the fact that they continue to want to be involved with the film and continue to want to work to further the work of the organizations that they're involved with. So I think it's all about the people, Greg. Really, well, I think we just got lucky in a lot of ways.
Absolutely, they are the people who are highlighted in this film are very, very compelling. And I want to just kind of touch on the major figures whom we meet in this film. There is a older couple of two men, Lawrence and Alexander, and they're actually very different ages. They met when the one was in his 20s and the other was in his 40s. So now at this point in time, I believe it's Alexander who is in failing health and in a nursing home. And it is his partner, Lawrence, 20-some years younger, who is devotedly taking care of him. Tell us more about these two men and their relationship and why it was important for them to be part of this film.
Because I think that they cross a lot of different areas to look at, not just the fact that they're an LGBT couple, but also that there is that age difference, which we found to be kind of, practically speaking, an advantage in caregiving. If you have somebody in your life who's 20 years younger than you, that certainly bodes well for you in aging successfully. It creates a whole set of problems for the younger person. Who's going to take care of that person? And sometimes that gets relegated to an afterthought. So that was part of the story. I think also the fact that this is a mixed race couple and who met at a time when the white person in the relationship was told by his friends that the person who was African American was just after him for his money. There was that whole kind of really ugly narrative that was going on, and they had to kind of overcome that. And that's a common feature that a lot of us have to go through as well. So I think when you can find subjects who kind of, for lack of a better term, check a lot of boxes in terms of like letting us relate to them. Like I can see myself in a lot of different ways with this couple. Maybe other people can too. That's really worth sharing. Mm. And also, they were Lawrence, the person who's the subject and the caregiver, the younger man, is just extremely eloquent and actually is a poet in his own right and was, a high school teacher.
Right. He's poetic in more ways than one, actually. And when I think about this couple, and of course, most of what we see is of them now, recently, with Alexander in a nursing home and Lawrence visiting day after day after day, and his devotion is just so touching. But you also tell us something, they tell us something of their relationship in the past. And I think one of the most interesting moments is when we are told that Alexander, that was the older of the two partners, at one point he was really anxious to make the house, their house, look as straight as possible for the sake of maybe shielding the nature of their relationship from certain people who might want to visit, or maybe it was for certain visitors that he would want the house to look very straight. And that's just kind of heartbreaking to think about somebody having to feel like even their own home cannot be a place that is perfectly open.
And I think that you've touched on the real core of the film. The message is that, you know, in our most private of spaces, the one place that many LGBT people, Q people, feel safest, their home, at a point in life when you, and it doesn't matter your age, you may have to do this at any point in your life, have to let others into it in order for you to survive, get quality care, get your house clean, whatever it is, just, you know, keep your life going. You have to trust others who may not approve of you. And there's an environment now where that is more acceptable and, in fact, allowable by law. And so you always have that background fear when you're letting people into your lives. Are they going to discriminate against me? There's that end of the spectrum. Are they going to harm me? There's, you know, it can go. Or are they just going to not really want to care about giving me the same quality of care, you know, for their own, because they have convictions that surpass their professional standards, you know. They feel more strongly about judging you as a person than they do about doing their job, basically.
Right. And at least once in the film, we are told of how many elderly gay people find themselves, in a sense, returning to the closet. They lived their lives closeted for a time, came out, but now at this point in time, feel compelled to be closeted again for fear that they are newly vulnerable and could potentially be prey to somebody's unkindness or insensitivity, which is a really sad prospect to think about.
Yeah, I mean, these are the people who fought hardest to come deepest out of the closet, now having to have a portion of their life, which is complete freedom that they discovered. It wasn't just given to them. And now they're having that taken away. You know, it isn't right.
We meet another couple, Sherry and Lois, two older women. And they are a very different pair. In a sense, a more equal pair, if you will, compared to Lawrence and Alexander. And we get more of a sense of what they have been in terms of the gay rights movement. And we're given the distinct impression that they have been powerful, outspoken advocates. Tell us more about these two women and why you found their story quite compelling.
This is the part where history is so interesting. Their story is from the beginning of the modern gay rights movement, you know, in the 60s, you know, and to hear them talk about, you know, attending the first Pride Parade in Boston, Massachusetts, with, you know, a couple dozen people, and trying to get people just to join them. I mean, these are things that make history exciting. You know, this is the stuff. These are the things that can motivate us, inspire us today, no matter where you come from, no matter who you are, to hear these stories of courage and ingenuity, really, that Lois and Sherry have about how they kind of started a movement within their own home for women who were losing their families, were having divorces and institutionalized because of, you know, they decided that they loved women instead of men, and their husbands, you know, had the power to do this to them. You know, these are stories that, you know, we can't lose. And so to hear them firsthand, first of all, was really important. And then to hear the challenges now that they have and their hopes for continuing to be activists, even where they are now, which is in a continuing care home. Not to spoil it, but we'll spoil it a little bit. The film is 9 years old, and they've moved on to other places in their lives. They're doing well, though. The fact that they have activism kind of in their DNA is inspiring, I thought. I hope it would inspire other people.
Absolutely. There is someone by the name of Mel whose story is very distinct from the others. And one thing that sets his story apart is that we never meet his partner. We only see pictures of him. Tell our listeners more about Mel and his particular story.
It was an interesting behind-the-scenes story about why you only see pictures. I can share with you if you like. But Mel found himself caregiving for his partner, and then finding that he needed to undergo cancer treatment. His partner didn't survive. He did, but I think, and I don't think I'm spoiling the film, I think that the most compelling part of Mel's story, I think, gives you some indication of what it's like. The moment when he says, I ask him, how long were you in the closet for, and how long did you not share it with anybody your 38-year relationship? He said, the entire time. We never told anybody for 38 years that we were a couple. Can you imagine? Mm. Can you imagine? I mean, and I hope there's a long enough pause in the film at that point, because that really needs to soak in that they're. And I think people want to think that that's irrational fear now, that that's okay. They're living in the past. And in fact, when I interviewed Mel back in 2010 for this, I thought, okay, this is an older man's fears from the past that aren't relevant to today. Well, that may have been 2011, but here in 2019, Mel was right, actually. He was right to be cautious. And, things do swing back, as he said. The pendulum has swung back the other way a little bit. And we all have to be a little more careful with who we're out with. And if you don't believe that's true, then I think it's important for you to look at the bubble that you, with all due respect, the bubble that you may be in and the privilege you may have.
Right, exactly. When I heard that, when I heard him say that, it brought to mind somebody that I know in my life. I want to be discreet here, but someone who was in a relationship, but pretty much entirely closeted the whole time that they were together. And one part of that couple was someone who was a coach. And so I think for him it felt particularly dangerous to perhaps come out of the closet as a gay man. And then at some point, it probably was not as dangerous as it would have been at the beginning. But at some point, this is just the life that you have. And it becomes, I should think, very difficult to make that leap from living the one way into living in this other way. And it isn't even that it's a lack of courage. But it is to make that leap is far more difficult than probably a lot of people from the outside looking in can possibly imagine. And certainly that leap proved to be an impossible leap for Mel. Only when his partner died did he finally feel able to be open.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think also it's easy for us to sit back here and say, well, it's just really hard to change. But they have the perspective of decades more of, life experience than we have. And they know what it's like. They've probably gone through this pendulum swing the way our society is going, it's called culture wars and whatever. This is not the first time they have been through that. And I think it's worth investigating what they have to offer as far as getting through this time. It would be wrong to think that their fears are irrational. that's, you know, I think that Mel probably did the right thing. Mel, by the way, is quite out now and as an open advocate for LGBT aging.
The other person featured in your film has a story quite distinct from the others, and yet there are very interesting through lines that draw it into the stories of the other. And we are talking about Chris Ann, who is transgender. She is a 59-year-old Vietnam vet who lived part of her life, the beginning of her life, as a male, but eventually transitioned to be a woman. Although I think without surgery, I think there's a term for that.
You're catching me off guard here.
I don't recall, but
there is. Yes.
She mentions that
as a cisgender male, I'm talking out of my depth, so I would turn to other trans and gender nonconforming people in the who may be listening.
Right. At any rate, Chris Ann finds herself in an especially difficult position for a couple of different reasons. Tell our listeners about her story and why it belongs in your film, Jen Silent.
Chris Ann, as you aptly described, transitioned late in life. So she had a long history of, and she had developed a family who identified her as a man. And when she decided that she wanted to transition to become a woman, that understandably was very difficult for a family who had looked at her one way their entire lives. So there's that tension there. I think there was also a great deal of estrangement that was already in place in this particular family, as there is in many families. There's nothing super unusual. It's a very common family situation. But when you combine those two with the fact that she suddenly is facing a life-threatening illness, that puts the pressure on all these areas that can go unaddressed for forever. And here we are in this film with Chris Ann not sure whether she's going to survive and her family not sure how involved they want to be in that process of taking care of her and because of her transition.
It's so interesting because it is an issue that any number of elderly people face. And for that matter, someone who is elderly, as I will be in a decade or two, and in some ways I'm already getting there at the age of 59, without children, it is also scary to think about later in life without children. But then on top of it, to add in these other issues where someone at least in some respects and in certain scenarios and arenas feels alone, feels like an outsider at a time when they are feeling so vulnerable and have new needs that they don't know how to have addressed. Of course, part of what makes her story also quite compelling is that she keeps something of a video journal that is also part of this film. Can you tell us more about that? Was that at your suggestion that she did that, or is that something she simply wanted to do on her own?
Well, Chris Ann was very interested in having a legacy once she realized that she was terminally ill. And I felt that part of my job was to give her that legacy and message that she felt was important to leave on to other people. To do that, I mean, part of the problem was that I'm a California-based filmmaker, and in this case, making a film on the East Coast, and things are happening very fast. At times, she would find herself in the hospital or in an ambulance, and we had, we were just not there. And so, empowering her with her own camera, and I believe this is actually—I don't even think she had a smartphone at that point, so it wasn't, But the concept of having her kind of self-document became very important. And at the time we were still using videotape. You know, so like there was a little camera with a little videotape in there, and I remember after it was all over, going into Chris Ann's home and looking at the camera that I had given her, and I could look in the little window where the tape was, and I could see that there was a little bit of tape that had been shot, and I knew that that was something that she had left for me to find after she was gone. And that's what you see in the film. And it's not easy to watch for me even to this day.
I am sure. I also think that she, at one point, when the film begins, she has been, in a sense, entirely abandoned by her family. Nobody in her family seemingly wants to have anything to do with her. And then at some point, one of her sons re-enters her life, at least for a time, at least intermittently. I wonder if you could just say a word about what it's like to be, in effect, a stranger in the room with a camera capturing a moment like that. What goes through your mind as that person who I should think, at least on some level, feels like an intruder, and yet it is so important for a scene like that to be captured and preserved and part of this film? Can you just say a word about that?
It is extremely uncomfortable. It is probably the most uncomfortable thing that I do in my work, and it feels invasive. It feels you're questioning whether you should actually be there for this moment. I recently had to do something very similar. And I think it's more than saying, well, the greater good requires that I be here for this and document it. It's more of a nonverbal contract with the people who are there that they want to share this moment and that you will share it in a way that is faithful and relevant to people outside the room. I'm not sure if I'm being very specific here, but you know, I think that there's a big misconception that people with cameras who are documenting or doing news want to be there and be voyeuristic. It's really the most uncomfortable thing that we have to do. And yet, you're right. What if that moment wasn't shared? What if those moments were not available for people to have a deeper understanding with? I don't think that the film and that would be as effective, and I don't think that its part in the movement of LGBT aging would have been as profound. So sometimes, you know, you just have to hit an audience over the head with these moments, and it certainly did for me being there. I can tell you physically, I was in these moments, I tried to be off in a corner somewhere. I'll even leave the camera rolling, and everybody knows that it's rolling at that point, and I will step out of the room. It's really a case-by-case basis. And usually the person who has the big bombshell to drop, in this case Chris Ann, telling her son that she's dying, wants us to be there for that. And the son, in this case, also wanted us to be there because it was important to his parents.
We're speaking with Stu Maddox, writer and director of a documentary called Jen Silent, which explores the experience of six different LGBTQ senior citizens contending with various difficulties and hurts and tensions in their lives, some of them common among the elderly and others more unique to those who are part of the gay community. One thing that I don't think we've yet really mentioned is that in addition to getting to know these really compelling human beings that we've been talking about just now, we also learn a little bit about the long-term care industry, healthcare system, and the way in which, at least in some instances, efforts are being made to help employees in such places to be better equipped to deal with this particular population. Tell us more about this particular group, I think centered in Boston, that is working really hard on this particular question?
We based our film in Boston, but it really was a microcosm of work going on all over the world. In fact, you have several important organizations in Wisconsin who are doing work trying to make sure that people who are paid caregivers, people who are also your peers in say, a continuing care facility, know that you have a particular needs that are unique. I'm going to say needs, maybe I should say a particular set of life experiences that require a little bit different approach because, you know, you are LGBTQ. This was a movement that has been going on long before we made the film, really kind of gained momentum in the last decade, and then has taken some serious hits with about 2016. So is kind of like so many things, re-entrenching itself and trying to kind of hold ground now and move forward again. The bottom line here is these are people who are trying to make sure the most vulnerable of us out there, no matter how we identify, are protected and have the ability to have quality care because they can be open about their lives. I mean, and that's a key, is being able to share your life allows the people who take care of you to know what to do. And so when that breakdown happens, that's what these folks are trying to do, is to avoid that disconnect there.
Right.
And it's not about like, hey, I want to have a pride parade, you know, down in front of the retirement community. This is about like, you know, this person who lives with me is not my sister. This is my long-term partner.
Right, and should be treated as such and welcomed as such.
Exactly, and celebrated, yes.
Right.
More than tolerating, it's celebrating.
Right, yeah. And an interesting point gets made at some point from somebody doing this work who says, I mean, it's very common for somebody who works in a nursing home to say, maybe with no malice whatsoever, we don't have any gay patients living in our facility. I mean, just kind of blithely making that assumption, not realizing that if the atmosphere is an unwelcoming one, they may very well have gay patients that the last thing they would ever do is reveal that about themselves, which I think is a really important point. And someone is even quoted as saying that even employees who themselves might be gay, if they're young and gay, it might not ever occur to them to think that among these elderly people with whom they're working, there might be people who are gay, who have gay partners, and who deserve to be cared for in an affirming, welcoming way.
It's true. There's such an invisibility on the part of older people in general, and then for this particular group of older people, it's just profound. And even with people who are like you, you're not there. So, the really amazing part is when there is a connection, there is an organization called SAGE, which does this really amazing thing called SAGE Table, where they get the people together, young and old. They break bread together. It's just a meal. They talk about, you know, the way things were, the way things are now. And it is fascinating, some of the stories these folks have to tell and some of the things that they learn from young people. It's just a great transference of information. And, it just makes so sad this invisibility that is there, not just with LGBT people, but with all older people.
Right, exactly. And that's so interesting, too, how the issues that this film raises are not limited to this particular community. I mean, there are concentric circles of concern that reach even beyond this community. I want to circle back to the first couple that we talked about, Lawrence and Alexander. We learn a lot about them through the course of the film, but one moment in particular that I think is especially sweet and interesting and speaks to what we've just now been talking about has to do with one of the things that Lawrence likes to do with Alexander, and that is to massage his hands with healing lotion. And he talks about how he does that now versus the way he would do that in the nursing home where Alexander used to be housed. Would you mind sharing that little bit of this film with our listeners?
Of course, and I would ask if we all could kind of put ourselves in Lawrence's shoes. And you have somebody who you're taking care of there, who you love and have spent your life with, and all you want to do, in Lawrence's words, is just put some hand lotion on his hands because, you know, his hands are dry. You know, being in a care facility, being in a hospital, there's, you know, it requires a person to kind of wash those kind of, make sure you don't get dehydrated, make sure your skin doesn't get dry. You know, these things that, you know, having a loved one really helps. And all Lawrence is trying to do is just put some lotion on his hands. And he said that in the first place that he and Alexander went to, he would have had to put the lotion on very quickly and very clinically and not be spotted doing it. And what an intimate moment that would have taken away compared to the place that he's at now with Alexander, where they are welcoming and celebrate their relationship. And he's able to sit there and for half a minute put the lotion on his hands and hold hands and have just briefly a moment like they used to have. And in Lawrence's eloquence, that sums up the entire issue. Just being able to do what everybody else does, have that little moment of love and intimacy.
Hmm. I want to commend you for a lot of beautiful, subtle touches in this film. It's a real work of art in the best sense of the word, including one wonderful moment when we see somebody dancing together. It's some kind of pride tea dance, and the song that is playing in the background is the song At Last. And that moment says so much. This film is chock full of them. It's just an eloquently constructed film in so many respects, and I hope many people are going to turn out to see it. Again, the film is titled Jen Silent. And it's going to be screened on the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College on Thursday, September 19th at 5:30 p.m. That will be in the Great Lakes Room. This screening is sponsored by Hospice Alliance and by St. Matthew's Episcopal Church Community Tithe. And it appears that admission is free. I'm pretty certain of that. And I hope a lot of people will turn out to see this film, which is actually not, at the moment at least, widely available. So this is a relatively rare opportunity to actually see this powerful film. And it's writer and director Stu Maddox. Stu Maddox, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was a real privilege to speak with you, and I very much enjoyed and appreciated your beautiful film. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thanks for the kind words.
And again, it is next Thursday that this lovely film, Jen Silent, will be screened on the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College at 5:30. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Rachel Dewoskin and a really interesting book called Repeat After Me, which stems in large part from her real-life experience teaching English in the nation of China. And on Monday, Peter Steiner and his new novel called The Good Cop, which is set in Munich in the turbulent years between the end of the First World War and the start of the Second World War. And that, of course, is the time when Adolf Hitler rose to power. It's a very powerful and compelling novel. And we'll talk with him on Monday's morning show. We want to remind you that you can enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week if you subscribe to the Morning Show podcast, which is available via all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. Make sure that you search for the title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. We're approaching 9 o'clock.